Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today we'll visit the University of Maine in Orono for a recent talk by U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. She was in Maine for two stops, one in Portland and this one in Orono. She gave a brief talk and then heard from a panel of six who shared their personal healthcare stories and then took questions on healthcare and insurance reform. A timely subject in light of this evening's address by President Obama, which will be carried live tonight at 8, both on MPBN radio and television. If you enjoy this program and would like to hear it again, it will be archived on our website, mpbn.net, a service made possible by member support. Look under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen for Audio On Demand, where you'll find a listing of available programs, including this, and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. Introducing the speaker is Jeanette Rivard, Director of the Workers' Compensation Board.
We have six panelists from throughout the state who have agreed to tell their healthcare story, their personal healthcare story. And I will introduce them briefly, and they will introduce themselves in greater detail when they tell us their story. We have Joe McSwain, Lee Roberts, Mary Morris-Dwelly, and to my right, George Rubino, John Hanley, and Dr. Stephanie Lash. Kathleen Sebelius was sworn in as the 21st Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services on April 28th of this year. The Secretary governs one of the largest civilian departments in the federal government, with more than 67,000 employees. HHS is the principal agency for protecting the health of all Americans by providing effective health and human services, especially for those who are least able to help themselves. Secretary Sebelius has over 20 years' experience in state government and has been a leader on health care issues for over a decade. As governor of the state of Kansas, she worked tirelessly to improve access to quality and affordable health care. She expanded newborn screening, put a renewed emphasis on childhood immunization, and increased eligibility for children's health coverage. More than 59,000 additional children were enrolled in health coverage during her time in office. Prior to her tenure as governor, Secretary Sebelius spent 8 years serving as the Kansas State Insurance Commissioner. In that capacity, she turned her department into a steadfast advocate for Kansas consumers and helped senior citizens save more than $7 million on prescription drugs. She won praise for drafting a proposed National Bill of Rights for patients. With this background, Secretary Sebelius is well poised to hear the health care concerns of the citizens of our state. Madam Secretary, welcome to Maine.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a delight to have a chance to be here today, and I just came from Portland, where I was with Congresswoman Pingree and a group from AARP and the Maine Women's Lobby talking about health insurance reform and the impact on women in Maine and around the country. And I'm delighted to be here at the University of Maine and have a chance, as I understand it, to experience one of the most beautiful days you've had this summer. So thank you for the weather. It highlights your gorgeous state in a wonderful way. I have had the privilege of serving with Governor Baldacci since I was elected governor in 2002. We were both elected the same year, re-elected the same year, and I know he has been a real champion for expanded health care and working on that. You have a great congressional delegation, and it's been my privilege not only to work with your senators, but also your members of Congress, and I think they not only represent Maine well, but represent the United States well, and have been, you know, hard at work on everything from home health care and expanded services, which is certainly one of Senator Collins' passions, to Senator Snow work with the Finance Committee to the Congresswoman's work on expanded drugs and making sure that people have access. So you have some real champions in the Congress and should be very proud of their service. I'm very pleased to be here, and I don't like to come any place without bearing a little good news. So I want to tell you, among other things, that Maine has qualified to be one of the 13 states which is going to receive a grant from the Department of Health and Human Services for expanded health insurance. The grant comes out of our Department of, yes. Riley, I know, and in the governor's office has been working on this, and there were many states who applied, but only 13 states will receive grants. About $70 million total is going to be allocated across the country, and $8.5 million is coming here to Maine. And it is really to expand coverage in three important areas: for direct care workers, for seasonal workers, and for part-time workers. So those dollars will be used to fill an important gap for people who are hard at work but don't right now have access to affordable health coverage, and I'm pleased to tell you about that. I also want to tell you, if you watched the news last night or read it in the papers this morning, that we yesterday announced an historic settlement with Pfizer about the false claims, frankly, they've been making about a series of drugs, marketing them for what's called off-label use, which really suggests that the drugs are able to attack areas and cure diseases that they are not authorized to do. So $2.3 billion was the fine and settlement that Pfizer finally agreed to, and about $2 million of that money will come back here to your Medicaid program. It's a reimbursement for the costs of really paying for drugs that weren't doing what they promised to do. So a little piece of good news on two fronts, and also it's an example, I think, of the kind of work that the Obama administration is very committed to, which is really cracking down on fraud and abuse. We have a task force underway with the Attorney General's office. The President asked the Attorney General and me to work together in an area, and we have not only strike forces who are now out around the country trying to get out ahead of fraud and abuse, people who are stealing from taxpayers and diverting what should be used for healthcare dollars into fraudulent activities, but also to take the practices like that of Pfizer, who is falsely advertising drugs that they're not authorized to do, to take that very seriously. So I just want to tell you that work, that's not a one-time shot, but it's work that is underway, and those dollars will be reappropriated to provide health services to citizens. Now, we're here a little bit to talk with your panel today about the reform efforts that are underway in Washington. And what I want to just mention at the outset, because there's been a lot of conversation and a lot of dialogue about what's going on in Congress and what's not going on in Congress and how things are going, we are closer to health reform than we've ever been in this country. And that's very good news. Congress has been hard at work in both the House and the Senate. Four or five committees have bills that have been completed, and the fifth committee has worked during the recess to move closer to that aim. And the bills all, while there's slight variations in the drafts that are on the table, about 90% of the bills are identical. So while there's been some focus on bits and pieces that may not be alike, and they really are aimed to do several things that the President said from the outset he thought were important: to lower costs for everyone and stabilize the current insurance base of the market, which provides coverage for about 180 million people, but is getting more and more difficult for small business owners to afford that coverage because they're often at the subject of the marketplace. It's often coverage that people can't rely on or can't keep. So stabilizing those costs, stabilizing the Medicare Trust Fund so it'll be around long into the future is a key component of the bill. Making sure that we change for once and for all the rules for insurance companies. So no longer in this country will insurance companies get to pick or choose who gets coverage and who doesn't. I know some significant work has gone on here in Maine, but in most states around the country, it is still totally legal, particularly in the small group and individual market, for companies to deny people coverage at all if you have a pre-existing condition. It's totally legal to dump folks when they get sick. You've been paying premiums, you get sick, you use your insurance, and you're out. To raise premiums to the point that people can no longer afford it. To rate by gender, so a 25-year-old woman in many states in this country pays three, four, five times as much as her 25-year-old male colleague. To age rate in a way that older Americans are often paying astronomical prices compared to their younger counterparts. And that those practices would not be allowed to exist any longer in a marketplace going forward. The coverage would provide for a new emphasis on health and wellness. I like to say to people, we have a great sickness care system in America. We don't have a great health care system. There's a lot of coverage available once you have a chronic disease or once you're ill, but not nearly enough attention on preventive care and primary care. So health reform gets rid of the copays for preventive screenings and primary care. It would dramatically lower drug costs for seniors who are now often hitting the so-called donut hole in Medicare, where they totally run out of coverage and often stop filling prescriptions because they can no longer afford to pay it 100% out of pocket. And the bill would be paid for. The president has committed, and the bills in the House and Senate make sure that we don't add to the deficit but pay for the health reform during the course of the program. Now, there's a lot of focus on those aspects and what may be good and what may be bad and what change. I just want to talk for just a minute before we hear from our panelists about what the status quo looks like, because that's really the alternative. Doing nothing has a huge cost as far as I'm concerned. We always talk about the cost of change. I want to talk just for a minute about the cost of status quo. And since the year 2000, insurance premiums for Maine citizens have doubled. So everyone here who has health insurance is now paying twice as much as you were just 9 years ago. The out-of-pocket costs for Medicare has also risen dramatically. The copays for Medicare Part D has risen dramatically. So there are new costs for insurance. In the status quo, where we are today, about 120,000 people in the state have no coverage at all. And I would say there are probably a couple hundred thousand Maine citizens who are the so-called underinsured, who have some kind of coverage if you have some kind of catastrophic event, but really don't have what people would call comprehensive coverage. You are currently looking at a situation where way too many people have illnesses or unfortunately die because of health-related injuries. 100,000 people in this country every year die from what happens to them in the hospital. Not from what took them to the hospital, but what happens to them while they're in the hospital. Either a hospital-related infection or a wrong site operation or incorrect medication or being released too soon that causes a downward spiral. And there's no plan in the status quo for changing that, for altering the quality of care people get day in and day out. The status quo is that in America, we spend over twice what any nation on earth spends for health care, and we live sicker and die younger. than any developed country in the world. That isn't a very good result for the money that's being spent. So health reform is really a comprehensive approach that redirects money from areas that are currently overpaying for equipment and devices, overpaying for some of the private insurance plans, redirecting those to services that we know in the long run make people healthier, add to life, add to prosperity. And there is a reason, I think, that we've been talking about this for almost 70 years in America, and that's because change is very hard. If you can imagine going back just 4 decades ago when there wasn't Medicare, when actually seniors reached a point where they, once they stopped working, there was no guarantee of health payments in their older years, where families struggled to put aside enough money so that if an aging parent had a health-related incident, they'd pay it out of a family budget. Medicare debate was ferocious and was hard-fought and only passed Congress by about 40 votes, even though there was a dramatic majority in both the House and the Senate in the mid-60s. I can't imagine anyone in Congress today, if they had to re-vote on Medicare, who would cancel it, any member of the House or the Senate. But that change was regarded as radical. It was called socialized medicine and government takeover in the era where it was vigorously debated. So we're at that point again in this country of looking at another major change for the rest of the population. I mean, now if you are a senior, you have access to a health security in those later years. But the rest of America still is on fairly precarious footing. And that's really what health reform is about. So I'm delighted to be here today, delighted to have a chance to talk about some of the real live situations here in Maine and what's happening to real people and why this reform is so very important. So thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for being here. We'll turn to our panelists now, and each of them has their own personal story about health care, either access, affordability, and so on. So we'll start with Joe.
Welcome, Secretary Sebelius. Thanks for hearing our stories. My name is Joe McSwain. I live in Edgecombe with my wife, Lisa, and we operate a company called Mid-Maine Restoration. Mid-Maine Restoration is a small niche construction company which specializes in the power of steeple work. About 1,000 years ago, I used to be a high school principal. This worked much safer. We're currently, we have a job site in Bangalore, which is at least part of the reason why I was able to be here today. MMR has been in existence for 25 years. We have had as many as 16 employees at times. Currently, we have 3. 10 years ago, give or take, Lisa and I decided that as responsible employers, we should offer our employees health insurance, vacation pay, paid holidays, dental plan, retirement plan, hydrogen pantry, you get the idea.
We were at that time able to offer our employees a Cadillac health insurance policy, and we, MMR, covered 100% of the cost. Our motives for this largesse of employee perks were not entirely altruistic. We hoped that the benefit package would help us keep our best employees. The strategy seems to have worked. MMR has stood the test of time, and we're still here now in the midst of the worst economy that I've ever seen. However, and that's a big however, our health insurance costs have risen between 15 and 25% every year since the inception of our plan. Think about those numbers. They're staggering. I wish my 401k had done that. I wouldn't care how much health care cost. What we did, our solution to these pernicious cost increases has been to repeatedly drop down to a less expensive and less efficacious plan. At present, we are all the way down to a catastrophic plan with astronomical deductibles and no drug coverages at all. This plan is useless to our employees. They will lose their houses before meeting the deductible. Ironically, it is useless to my family as well. I'll show you how. After meeting the deductible, the policy covers 80% of all costs incurred. Therefore, if I should happen to get hit by a bus and run up a $1.5 million medical bill, which isn't really that hard to do nowadays, I'll be on the hook for in excess of $300,000. I lose my house too, and probably my business. We need a public option, and we need it now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Secretary, for coming to Maine and bringing the weather. It was very reassuring to hear what you have to say. I'm here because I'm someone who had pre-existing conditions. I'm really grateful to the organizers who made this possible, too. I'm one of the lucky ones. I'm healthy. I'm going to compete in a triathlon on Sunday. I'm, 200 other really healthy people are going to run around and, I don't know, take T-shirts home. We're happy. We're healthy. Millions of others are not so lucky. They've lost their homes, they've lost their health, they've lost their businesses and their way of life because of our country's healthcare chaos. It's not a system. I'm lucky to have had, in my mid-20s, cervical cancer. It's a cancer, I'm lucky to have had cervical cancer. It's a very curable cancer. I'm lucky to have lived 25 years without a recurrence. Like every cancer survivor, I worry about recurrence. The fact that I could never, ever, ever, for 1 minute, have a break in health insurance. Well, it used to be 1 minute. Now it's 30 days. has become an intrinsic part of my life. Access to health insurance determined what work I did, whether I was in school, whether I went to graduate school, when I went to graduate school, my marriageability. And it was eventually put at risk by a divorce. Nevertheless, I'm lucky to have had an education and a sort of middle-class upbringing that enabled me to keep stringing jobs together, that kept me in jobs and health insurance. And as a teacher who teaches kids of all abilities and all socioeconomic levels, I know a lot of people aren't that lucky. When I left British Airways, my first job right out of college, and came home to Maine during my little cancer mini-drama, I used COBRA. And even in the 80s, it was $5,000 a year. It was outrageous then, but it was all I had, and I had to pay it. I found work as a social editor and then a reporter for a Rockland newspaper, and then those jobs included insurance. I was lucky. Then I put my degree to work and taught English and dance in Lincoln County. I married, had a child in my 40s, and left my teaching job thinking that I'd be secure. And I found that I had to leave that marriage. My position as the single employee in my husband's lobstering business was a problem. As soon as I left, I had no health insurance. He didn't tell me, but anyway. since 2003, I have patched together coverage through work and catastrophic policies with out-of-reach deductibles. It's not been pretty. More than once, by the time I got billed for a visit, or a test or a procedure, the policy that originally covered it no longer applied. And when I called the insurance companies or wrote to them, you would have thought I was asking them to unearth Sumerian tablets, the way they, reacted to, oh, what policy did you have? Was that covered? Many times I simply paid the bill. And I think some of the insurance company's favorite client. Because not only do I pay the policy, sometimes I just pay the bill. Now, because of the economy and my sort of expensive teaching experience, I'm going back into teaching, and I'm working as a long-term substitute, and I'm out of contract. The school I work for, Georges Valley in Thomaston, is gracious They know my situation. They don't have to pay my health insurance. They are. I mean, I'm lucky again. I'm lucky and grateful. And tens of thousands of Americans don't have that kind of good fortune. I, too, would like a public option. Thanks again.
I'm Mary Morse Dwelly. Some of the people in this room know me, and they'll be amazed at what I'm going to say. For one thing, I am 59 years old, and I'm praying to become eligible for Medicare. What a relief that would be for my family, not to have to worry month to month. I'm a mother of two grown children, one of which is in the back of the room, and a wife and business partner to my husband, who's a solo practitioner eye doctor in the city of Bangor. We are struggling to keep the doors open, and thank God our one non-family member employee has insurance through her husband. I'm praying they don't get divorced, because we could honestly not afford to provide health insurance for our employees. Along the way, through my married life, I've had three serious bouts of illness. The cost of health insurance is incredible. The cost when we first started with my family of four was $500 a month. And in 1986, that seemed like a lot of money every month. But it grew to $2,200 a month, 2008, 2009. That's over $25,000 a year. And that doesn't include, that's a $10,000 deductible. That is co-pays and out-of-pockets, not included. So the cost of my drugs and everything, our whole family, it's astronomical. The insurance company and the infinite wisdom have created a lovely three-tier reimbursement system for drugs and services. So by the time you get to a name brand drug, you can't afford it anyway. So we find ourselves, even as medical care providers, we find ourselves going without the drugs that our doctors have recommended that we take, which to me is ridiculous. My first bout was in 1987. It was a burst appendix. I was sent home from the hospital with it burst because it was a weekend, and they didn't want to call in a sonographer. I, 72 hours later, was in critical condition in the hospital with a surgeon just not holding out much hope. That was a 12-day stay in the hospital with a resulting $25,000 worth of debt directly to us over and above what our insurance covered. The second one was in 1999. I went in for prophylactic treatment of diverticulosis. The surgery went bad. I ended up in the hospital for 60 days, 40-something of which was in ICU. I can remember coming to an ICU saying to my husband, "Did you pay the health insurance premium?" Then my last major bout was in 2002, and I had a perforated bowel. Not a pretty thing, but mine, fortunately, I have to do everything large, if you know me. It was perforated in three places. So I was in the hospital for 109 days, in and out of ICU, given less than a 10% chance to live. We came out of that hospital stay and 2 years of me being bedridden with some assistance with nursing care. But my husband and children were considered educable, so insurance withdrew the nursing care early. So that was fun. We came out of that one owing well over $100,000 in uncovered and copay costs. So as my little spiel can tell you, this economic model for the insurance industry is not working for me. I don't think it's working for anybody except the executives of insurance companies. When I see my insurance premiums going up, it drives me crazy. But nobody, when coming to an ICU, should have to look at their spouse and say, did you pay the health insurance? Not in America. I did. When discussing life-saving practices with your physicians and your surgeons, no American should have to say, is that covered by my insurance? Shouldn't happen here. Long, lonely nights of figuring, oh, should I have it or should I die? You know, that's not right in a developed country. Then moving on, this is my fun part. Robbing Peter to pay Paul has become a game in our house. Now, in America, we are deciding whether to pay health insurance or taxes. Sorry. Taxes, health insurance, or mortgage. Health insurance, college tuition. Health insurance, and anything else in our life. This is wrong in a developed, westernized culture. The role of government, if there's never been a more, to me, and I've been an activist all my life, there has never been a clearer role for government for me. We need a public option. We need it now, and we need to rescue those of us who are working our tails off and still can't afford health insurance. We cover the elderly with Medicare. We cover the poor with Medicaid. Why are we being excluded as the workers of the world and the tax, hopefully, taxpayers of the world, of our country? Why are we the only ones excluded from government coverage for health insurance? A national health care policy must be put in place so companies cannot skim the top. Progressive states like ours, bless our hearts. We've done well here, but we have but two major players in the health insurance industry here. And if Anthem or Aetna, and I understand Cigna's pulling out in January, if they don't want you, you don't get coverage. And if you're an individual, or in our case, we're not even small, we're micro business, your group rates are a joke. We pay, as I told you, through the nose. So that's the end of it. It's been a long struggle, and I think it's one that hopefully will come to an end, because nobody should have to work in America for health insurance. It should be a right.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Secretary and President Obama, for your efforts to reform health care. I am self-employed, and for 35 years, I've been making violin, viola, cello, and double bass bows for professional string players in the United States and internationally. I am also a professional double bass player. Through a business association, I purchased health insurance. I was assured that my policy covered a colonoscopy. After receiving approval from the company's representative, I scheduled one. In the process, the doctor removed a polyp. My insurance company defined this as an unapproved surgery and denied my claim. My health insurance benefits changed while I was under anesthesia. It took many months and several contacts with the state insurance commissioner before I received a partial payment for my claim. I have another brief story. It's about my college roommate, Al. Excuse me. My friend Al died because he was denied health care. Because he had no insurance, the emergency room sent him home, telling him that he had indigestion. It had been a heart attack. My friend Al died 4 days later. These are two reasons why we need health reform now, and we can't wait. Thank you for letting me tell my story today.
Madam Secretary, welcome to the state of Maine. Fortunately, my wife and I still have good insurance because we're both retired auto workers. But after I retired, we relocated back to Maine, and I needed something to do because I was bored, so I started a little home health care corporation. And we currently provide between 400,000 and 500,000 hours of service per year. servicing Maine's aged and disabled. And as you know, healthcare workers are among the lowest paid workers in the United States. Our current healthcare system is so flawed that when a worker in our field, which a lot of them are part-timers, earns enough wages in a week to force them to lose Medicaid, they come to me, and it's happened on many occasions, and ask me to either reduce their wages or reduce their hours. Because they need to keep Maine Care, which is our Medicaid up here in Maine, because there's no way that these people can not go without coverage. Most of them are single mothers with children. And currently, there are no avenues for these types of workers to achieve upward mobility, which has always been a standard in our country. In the state of Maine, if you don't get Maine Care, you get nothing. And if you get nothing, you can't go from here to there. I can't provide health care workers insurance. I don't have $10 an hour to pay them in wages, much less $10 an hour to pay for their insurance. And it's just, it's a shame. I've got 45 people working for us. None of them have health care. I can't even afford it for my administrator. So something's got to be done, and we need to keep a public option in there because these companies are not going to reach down and help these people that really, really need help. Thank you very much for it.
Thank you, Secretary Sebelius, for coming and hearing our stories, and thank you to everybody who's taken the time to participate in this. I'm a neurologist. I've been practicing here in Bangor for 17 years, and one of the stories I want to tell you is about a patient of mine. This is a 23-year-old young man who works full-time for Community Health and Counseling, which is an agency that provides support here in Bangor. Despite working full-time for an agency that provides health care services, he has no insurance, and I take care of him because of his epilepsy. His seizures can be controlled by medication, but unfortunately the medication that works to control his seizures is beyond his ability to afford. So despite remembering to take his medications and getting enough sleep at night and taking good care of himself, we've had to put him on a less expensive medication, which doesn't work adequately for him. 3 weeks ago, he had a generalized seizure, and he fell, and he dislocated his shoulder, which then required a visit to the emergency room, which cost more than a year of the expense of medication. 2 weeks ago, he got married, and he walked down the aisle with a sling on his arm and medical bills around his neck, and I don't think that that's in anybody's interest. Another one of the hats that I wear is I've been president of our practice of nine neurologists for the past 6 years, and I can tell you that we truly go to extraordinary lengths to try to get doctors to come and see the patients in Maine. And part of it is because we don't have a medical school here in Maine, but a large part of it is because of reimbursement. Our practice serves geographically two-thirds of the state of Maine, which is a large area, and we subserve slightly under half of the population of Maine. And ethically, we feel very strongly that we need to see patients regardless of their ability to pay, such as the gentleman I just talked about. Because of this, the amount that we're able to pay ourselves and our employees is less than national benchmarks. And I can tell you that our present child neurologist is from Nigeria. Our present principal person that takes care of epilepsy patients is from Argentina. We have two neuromuscular people in our practice, one who's from the Czech Republic and one who's from the Philippines. Our last pediatric neurologist came from Scotland, trained in Canada, and then went back to Canada because she's better reimbursed in Canada. In the 6 years that I've been president of our practice, I have never stopped recruiting physicians. We are understaffed by several, and we can't get people to come and stay. It's really an extraordinary problem. So not only can people not see us and not get the medicines they need, but we, in the larger sense of trained healthcare providers, aren't here to take care of them. A third hat that I wear is I'm president of the Maine Medical Association, and I'm very honored to be in that position. In a couple of weeks, I'll be done, and the person following me is here in the room. I'm going to be followed by Dr. David McDermott. But in my swan song, I'd like to say that last fall, the Maine Medical Association did a survey of the physicians in Maine, and one of the last questions on that survey was a question about universal health coverage. And the majority of the physicians who answered that question, and it was a very representative sample, said that they support universal health insurance, which in the time that I've been here practicing in Maine feels like a real change. I'm quite confident that it is. I think that the majority of us who are now trying to take care of patients are finding that to be an overwhelming problem. And along with the attitudes of patients and families and friends, the attitudes of physicians have changed. Thank you very much.
We do have time for very few questions, and so we will open it up.
Hi, my name is William Rice. I live in Trenton in Hancock County, and this is a question for the Secretary. Recently, the doctor indicated I should have a certain procedure done, and I got a letter from the insurance company approving it happily, but in reading it over, I saw all sorts of restrictions on when it could be done and where it could be done and everything else, and I'm just wondering, when people talk about bureaucrats getting between you and your doctor, whether it can't be made more clear, and most of us know there already is a bureaucrat sitting in the examining room, and he or she works for a private insurance company. So in any sort of large industrialized country like ours where you have a large centralized insurance system, there's going to be bureaucrats involved. The question is whether they're going to work for Wall Street or work for us in terms of a public option. And I hope that that simple idea would be made clearer to people when they bring up that false idea about the government getting between you and your doctor. Thank you.
Well, it's not a great question. It's a great point. And I spent 8 years as the insurance commissioner of Kansas, and what I did each and every day is fight on behalf of people who had coverage to try and access the benefits they paid for. So you're absolutely right. That blockade about what prescription you can get, what procedure you can have, how long you'll stay in the hospital is not made by doctors too often. It's made by insurance companies, and that's part of what has to change.
Gentleman in the white shirt here.
Thank you. My name is Sean Lewin. I live here in Old Town, and I'm a member of the AARP's Capital City Task Force that works with the legislators in Augusta. When Part D was put in place, your predecessor was pretty much handcuffed from dealing with the pharmaceutical industry and negotiating, even though we are now the largest purchaser of prescription drugs in the world under the Medicare's Part D. And the issue of drugs like insulin, which is still not being regulated as other generic drugs, seems as if it's just a terrible abuse that the pharmaceutical industry has put on us, even though we have them here and our citizens work for them and they're our citizens. And yet the greed and the graft and the corruption, it seems as if, which has impacted every one of us, because they're making an extra nickel a pill or $50 a pill or whatever, it just seems unconscionable. And I hope that whatever comes of this gives you some power to negotiate and maybe helps them use some common sense that they could, if they have all the money but they've destroyed our country, what do they have? You know? Thank you.
Again, thank you. Part D, as you correctly point out, not only discouraged but prohibited Health and Human Services from negotiating the best price. So in Maine, for instance, your Medicaid plan can negotiate for drugs. And if a citizen is taking insulin under Medicaid, they're paying a far lower rate than if they are on Medicare and taking insulin, and that is addressed in health reform. It's part of the plan to actually substantially lower drug costs for Medicare patients. We pay more for each and every drug out of Medicare than any nation on earth, and most of them are made right here. I mean, there are drugs, and yet you can go to Canada, which a number of your legislators have done in the past and citizens have done in the past, or Mexico or Germany or England or any place else, and get the drug that is actually developed in America, made in America, but cheaper to purchase any place else but America. So that, you're absolutely right, needs to change.
Back row.
Thank you very much. My name is Emily Kane. I'm the state representative here in Orono, and I'm the chair, House Chair of the Appropriations and Financial Affairs Committee here in the state legislature. I know very well what our major drivers are in our budget, why we can't afford to do more. And I think one of the biggest obstacles we have is a cultural one about how we view healthcare, not only viewing it as a right, as Mary said, but also viewing it as prevention first, and not waiting until the last minute. I know from looking at our budgets where our cost drivers are, and they're more in emergency care than they are in prevention. I want to spend as much on prevention as we do on emergency care. I'm hoping you can talk a little bit more about one of the comments you made earlier about focusing on prevention in this plan, and how you plan to approach that, not only from a technical perspective, but really how do you culturally change the behavior to one where people think first about prevention and not, I have to wait to the last minute and get the highest cost care I possibly can. Because I think that's the only way that the state can work with the federal government in order to bring down the cost for everybody. Thank you very much for coming to the University of Maine today.
Well, thank you for your service as a recovering state legislator. I know what you go through each and every day, and it's very important service, so thank you. You're absolutely right. Right now, we spend 8 cents about of every healthcare dollar on prevention and wellness, and 75 cents of every healthcare dollar on chronic disease and illness. So it is a look at kind of the way the system is balanced. We won't pay, for instance, for a pre-diabetic to help change patterns and lower blood sugar, but will pay to amputate a foot if you have diabetes and that's the result. Again, not a very smart strategy. So part of what the bills do is really there is increased reimbursement for a number of the primary care and general internist doctors. That I think is a critical part of this, to make sure that we have not only encourage more medical students to choose those roles, but make sure we have the workload to have a health home for everyone. There are measures to provide incentives for individuals to help make healthier choices, stop smoking, get into an exercise plan, things that we know result in underlying huge costs down the road, but if we can switch them. In the Recovery Act, the precursor to the health reform debate, there is a major amount of new funding for a national prevention effort funded under the Centers for Disease Control. The first time ever we will spend money, and it's likely to be in 30 or 40 communities around the state, measurable, serious looks at how you begin to change behaviors and how we encourage everything from healthier eating to exercise to smoking cessation, which we know, again, weigh in. And there are huge incentives built into the bill so that the kinds of basic and primary care provided would not have copays. What we know is that even with a copay situation, often it's a discouragement for people to go get a cancer screening or go obtain the prescription. So I think there's some things we can do in terms of incentives for the physician community. There are things that can be the way that the health plans are built, but all of those efforts, and then there's some kind of social changes in terms of how money is spent, but all of those are part of the comprehensive reform bill.
You're going to hold it? Yeah. Okay, there. Thank you. Thank you, Secretary. This question is for you, too. I'm so glad to hear about your background, because as you recognized here in Maine, a lot of us have worked very hard. Oh, my name is Barbara Cates, by the way, and I'm a volunteer of the Maine People's Alliance. And I've been advocating on healthcare issues for about 10 years, and a lot of the changes that have happened here in Maine is because of the work of the many people in this room who've worked really hard on it. And one of the things that we've learned in the process is that the insurance companies are really good at the fine print. So where a lot of things happen when we go through the legislative process, of course, is in the regulatory process. And I'm so glad to hear about your background, because you clearly are really good at the fine print, too. And we're really going to need you there for us. Once we get health care reform through, that's where things, as you know, things are really going to happen, and we'll really find out what it's going to do for us back here at home. Are there ways that we advocates can be helpful once we get to that point, when you're doing that work? What's our role then?
Well, I think that first we've got to get the bill passed. And clearly your input to not only your own delegation, who can be instrumental in pushing this forward, but I would suggest that probably all of you have friends and acquaintances and kids and outreach in other states. And I think sharing the stories of here in Maine, I mean, Maine has done really an amazing job as a state pushing the envelope on this area. You've learned a lot of good lessons, but I think one of the lessons that's very clear is states can't do it alone, that we really need a national effort. We need a national solution, because trying to change things, I found that in Kansas, you find it in Maine. I mean, you get to a point where you run into a brick wall because the programs are just too big and you can't make enough of a dent. So I would say let's push that on. And then when we get to the point, a lot of health reform is what happens after the bill is passed and the kinds of programs. So we are going to be learning a lot from the states who actually have a lot of innovative strategies in place and push it forward. One of the things that we're going to be doing, Representative, is I hope focusing a lot more time and attention on the dual eligible population, so the folks who qualify for Medicare but also qualify for Medicaid, who often are kind of they're sort of half a state and half a federal program, and not enough time and attention is paid on healthier and more directed care. So we're going to have a lot of hopefully efforts going on that are real partnerships with states like Maine and states around the country to develop best practices and then try and really expand those across the country. So get ready. You'll be on the front lines.
I think that, as I mentioned before, that needed to be our last question, unfortunately. I do want to thank, on behalf of the sponsoring organizations here today, I want to thank all of you for being here, and I want to thank the panelists for telling their stories, but most of all, thank you for being here to hear the stories.
Well. You've been listening to a speech by Kathleen Sebelius, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary, on Speaking in Maine. She gave a talk on health care and insurance reform. For more on health care, tune in this evening at 8 when President Obama delivers his health care address, which will be broadcast live both on MPBN radio and television. If you missed part of this Speaking in Maine program or enjoyed it and would like to hear it again, you can do so by visiting mpbn.net and clicking on Audio On Demand under the On Demand tab at the top of your screen. There you'll find this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs. A service made possible by member support. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Gordon Fellis.